We got Jeremiah, first of all, if we're on the right page of the lectionary. Not an easy little piece. Where were we last week? Oh, Isaiah 6. That wasn't easy either, but a little bit more familiar. But you get into poetry here, and as usual, you run up against both some tough vocabulary and some tough syntax. Jeremiah 17, 5 to 8, which is kind of, unfortunately, in the middle of things. We jump into Jeremiah in chapter 17. Remember that Jeremiah's essential problem is that nobody listens to him. Both the people to whom he is delivering a message that is predominantly one of law and judgment, at least until they realize the consequences of their sins, which happens very, in a dramatic way in 586 with the destruction of Jerusalem. But not only does his audience not listen to him, he's quite convinced God doesn't listen to him either, at least at times. And you have these marvelous little confessions where he sort of pours out his heart to God. These are sort of a pastor's best friend sometimes when you really think that what you are about is not gaining any ground, and you've got second thoughts whether God even wants you in the business or not. Now, we're sort of in the middle of that theme here, though this isn't by far the sort of most poignant of Jeremiah's confessions. But he's been kind of complaining that this isn't providing any fruit, and that all he's getting out of this is an ulcer. In the previous verses, it confirms that Judah's judgment is fixed, and that's kind of the theme here. There's nothing anybody can do, almost, barring full repentance, which seems quite unlikely. But the fate is fixed. Judah will be destroyed. And you know that Jeremiah's opponents are really saying to him, you got the wrong message. In fact, God is going to bail us out. There will be peace. Isn't that, after all, the message of the kingdom of God, that everything's fine, that God is a God of grace, that God is a God of victory, that God will do everything for his people no matter what? And you sort of have that cheap grace, false security model against which Jeremiah is preaching. So it's become clear to him that there is destruction, and he's got to stand his ground even against the opposition. Well, how does he respond to this? Let's pick it up. Let's get to the text here. Verse 5, Kol Amar Yahweh. Yahweh speaks to him. He's been worried that God really hasn't been listening, yet God has, of course, and God responds, at least to some degree. Thus said Yahweh, Arur ha-gever asher yivtach ba'adam. Well, you can almost translate this. Arur is the passive participle of arar, a geminate verb, aleph resh resh, that is the strong verb for curse. All right, so this is cursed, is the gever. Now, gever is one of several words for person. A gever is a male, clearly male, roughly a synonym of ish, which is probably the idea here, though gever usually has the idea of kind of a virile man, a macho guy, a manly man, or like a soldier, a warrior, that kind of a thing. You know the word gibor, perhaps. We haven't had this yet in beginning Hebrew, but gibor really means a soldier, a warrior, and it's the same root, gavar, to be kind of a tough guy. This may be little more than a parallel to Ish, however, but maybe not. Probably his interlocutors were guys who were pretty strong about it. Cursed is the guy who yivtach, who imperfect of batak, who will or keeps on trusting be Adam, in Adam. Now, here's a nice sense of Adam, not as a proper noun or even as the noun for a human, but really for humanity, for a man, in human things, in the man. And Psalm, the perfect of seem, though it's while consecutive, matched to Yivtach, and who puts, now it's a little tough to figure out the syntax here, and who puts basar, we've had basar, flesh or meat, but here in the sense of human flesh, his zeroa. Zero is the word for arm, also to indicate strength, just like a hand indicates strength, so arm. And who, so you could translate this, and who makes flesh, i.e. human flesh, his strength. Which isn't a bad parallel to the first half. You kind of get the point. I puzzled and wondered if Zeroa isn't the direct object. And who puts his strength, and now you need to add a preposition to Basar, in Basar, which is even a nicer parallel to the first half of the line. Who trusts in man, who puts his strength in Basar, in flesh. The only problem with that is that there's no preposition on Basar. But you could argue that due to the poetic style, you've got to steal a preposition from the first half. In other words, a preposition does double duty here. And that's not impossible. In fact, it's quite common in parallel poetry. But the point is the same, all right? And min Yahweh, and from Yahweh, Yasur, libo. The subject of Yasur is libo. His lave, his heart, turns away, goes away. Any questions? 6. Vahaya ka ar'a ba'arba. Or ba'arava. There, it's 3 syllables. Here's another place where you'll never see this in English, and not that it makes a whole lot of difference, but look at the little word play here. The noun R, like an R, K-R-R, is some plant, all right? And you can look it up, and of course the commentaries will say that this is the Junipericus something other us, and you can go check it in your Encyclopedia Flora and Fauna. I've never been terribly fulfilled by those kinds of discussions, but it's some kind of a desert shrub, probably a juniper bush. And Araba, you should know, that's a technical term. The Araba is the rift, the Jordan Rift Valley, below the Sea of, below the Dead Sea, where it's just a dead desert valley, and becomes by extension a word for desert. He will be like a juniper bush in the desert, or in the Araba. Fair enough, all right? But again, note the wordplay. It doesn't say a juniper bush in the desert. It says he will be like an RR in the Araba. And you get that play with the olive, with the I in there. And not, he will see, ki, either that or when, yavo tov. When Tov will bow. Get it? And he will not see when good will come. Or he will not see that good will come. He's sitting out there in the desert. Almost a self-made desert, if you will, extend the metaphor. Because he trusts in things that don't provide Tov. You might find in translation, Tov here translated more as a rain or water or something that you would need in the desert, simply A, because that's the image here, and B, because later on he's going to talk about heat and drought, so Tov may be the opposite of that. But there are other words for rain that he could have used here, and I think Tov here is a loaded term. On the one hand, it could mean specifically those things that are good with reference to being in the desert. But more than that, it's good with reference to a much broader understanding of Tov. which is good in a very general sense, but never separated from God alone, who is Tov, and the God who at the beginning first made everything, Tov. And verse 6b, Shakan, he will, Shakan, dwell impermanently, inhabit, tabernacle. The Chararim Bamidbar. Now, Chararim is a hapax legomenon, so I will not apologize for not knowing the word. I looked it up. Charar, the verbal root charar, means to burn. So you can guess that this is some noun related to burning, and since we're talking about the desert, and here we're in the Midbar, fill in the blank. He will dwell in a burning, in like a burning in the Midbar, a land, an eretz of melecha. Now, melech is salt, a land of salt, and lo teshev. Now, teshev is the imperfect of yashav in either the second singular masculine or the third singular feminine. It's not sure what the subject here. And a land of salt, and not you will dwell. This is probably idiomatic just for a place where no one would dwell. I mean, we might say it's a place where you wouldn't live. No man's land, pretty good. Or uninhabitable place. So he will dwell desert in the, like heat or burning in the wilderness, a land of salt, and where you sure wouldn't live. Something like that. You wouldn't live. By the way, the reference to salt here may well have to do with the Dead Sea and the whole image of salt and deadness and the desert. Salt and earth always go together, too, as a metaphor for death. I mean, if you spill your driveway salt on the grass, it'll kill it, and that's true. The curses in biblical times always had this. This was one of the lines in the curse. May your house be turned upside down, your land made waste and sowed with salt. Where are we? 7. Baruch. Aha. This is obviously the opposite of arur. Baruch is the passive participle of the verb barak, to bless. It's also Jeremiah's scribe's name, but that may not be the point here. His name meant blessed, all right? But look at the contrast here. You really have to see this as, dare we say, law and gospel. You've got a nice contrast here between the arur in 5b and the baruch in 7. And note it goes on here with the same business. Baruch is the giver who yiftach b'Yahweh. Blessed is the guy, the giver, who will trust in Yahweh. And Yahweh will be mivtacho, his mivtach. Now, this is a noun from the verb batak. You can figure it out. If batak means to trust, the noun mivtach must be something like trust or security. 8. He will be like an eitz, like a tree, shatul, another passive participle, which means planted. Actually, shatal means to transplant. It's interesting. Does this ring a bell, by the way? This whole business, doesn't this sound exactly like Psalm 1, which it is. Now, we'll talk about that at the end, maybe. He will be like a tree replanted upon Mayim and upon a yuval. Yuval, there's a verb, yaval, that means to bear, carry, somewhat similar to nasa. This is a use of it as a noun. You'll notice it's the object of the preposition al. And upon, it's a hapax legomenon as a noun, all right? So it means something that carries something, would be the implication here. And since we're talking about water, this is probably a water course of some kind, whether it's a channel, an aqueduct, a stream. Remember in Psalm 1, you get streams here, or channels, the word for channels. Peleg is the noun there. Or an irrigation canal, which could be true too. But I think the point is well taken. And upon a water course of some kind, Yishalach Sharashau. Now look at Yishalach. Those of you who are in beginning Hebrew, this is next Monday's lesson. Here is the verb shalach, which we know. It means to send. But the verb form is now the next conjugation we're going to look at. This is not kal, but piel. And the main mark of a piel, for those of you who know, is doubling of the middle root letter. You'll see the dagesh forte in the middle root letter. You'll also see that the imperfect prefix is one we've already learned, the yod, but here it has a schwa under it. So the consonants are the same. The vowels can be a little different. Now, what does the piel do to the kal? It intensifies it. Instead of just send, it means to send out with force or purpose. When Pharaoh gets rid of the Hebrews from Egypt, he sends them in the piel, which is should really be translated, he drove them out, or he expelled them from Egypt, which is an odd irony since that was never his intention to even let them go, but he kicks them out. Now here it's referring to the plant or the tree, and upon a water course of some sort, it sends forth with intent, might be the implication of the piel. It's shoresh. Shoresh is the word for root, usually in the plural, roots. Its roots. Get it? And not, verse 8, and not year A. Now look at this one. All right, here, play a little junior text critic here. And not year A. Now there's something funny about this verb form, though even the beginning Hebrew guys know, should be able to parse this, right? If you had a look at this, what do you see? You see an imperfect prefix, right? You see two root letters, resh and aleph. Now, you got to go shopping for a third root letter. Your instinct would be a third hey, especially since there's a root ra'ah, and especially since that makes perfectly good sense here, and especially since it's an exact parallel to verse 6 up top. The second half of verse 6a, he will not see when good will come. Go down to line 8b, and not he will see when chom yavo. Chom is the word for heat. He will not see when heat will come. Now, that would imply, of course, that year A is the imperfect of ra'ah, and it should have a hay on it. So either a scribe dropped the ball and lost the hay along the way, or something else is going on. Now you'll see, and this is a good example of kathiv and karei, that in the margin, and if you got BHS, you look in the right margin, and you see that little kof over there, it's the second entry reading from right to left, a kof with a dot above it, and then it's got in real small letters year A, or the form of ra'ah we've just analyzed with a hey at the end. That's telling you that that's what the scribes read here. And the vowels that they put into the text are the vowels for that, which would make perfectly good sense when going back into the text itself, except that you don't have a hey at the end. Now, the kathiv is what's written. What's written is not from the verb ra'ah at all, but is from the verb yare, to be afraid. The yod is prefix. The yod of the root should ordinarily be there, but it would be defective spelling. And the resh then is the second root letter, and the aleph the third root letter, so every of the pieces are really here. Now, yare means to be afraid. In which case you'd translate this, and he will not be afraid when the heat comes. Which actually makes even more sense than C. Now, if that's right, then this isn't an exact parallel to the previous phrase in verse 6, but is a parallel with a twist, you see. And there's actually a pun between ra'ah to see and yare to fear, two verbs that every Hebrew student from time immemorial has confused anyway. But here's perhaps a place where the poet is wanting you to get a little confused and actually playing on the similarity to make wordplay. Now, here's one, too, where it's fun to consult English translations and see. I think most of them go with fear here, reading the cathive, not the kare, though you might find English translations that read see here. In the end, both of them make sense, though I would favor the fear. It's kind of the harder reading, if you will, to switch gears when you got a nice parallel up there, and it allows the poetry to have a little bit of a wordplay, which is always kind of nice, and it makes perfectly good sense. He will not fear when the heat comes, and Vahaya will be Alehu. It's Allah stuff. Now, this is the verb. It's from the verbal root Allah, to go up, but this is the noun for what plants send up, otherwise known as foliage, and the pronominal suffix ehu. And its foliage will be ra'anan, which is an adjective for rich with reference to plants. I don't know what would we say. Luxurious, real green. pick something that describes plants that are doing very well. And Bashnath, in the year of Batsoreth, this is a word you probably don't know. Batsoreth means drought. And in a year of drought, not it will da'ag. Da'ag is a root that means to be anxious. Somewhat of a parallel to fear, you see, which is more support for reading fear in the previous line. He will not be anxious, and not yamish. Mish means to fail or don't do something. And it will not fail from asoth. Hey, asoth, parse this, guys, Hebrew 1. Asoth is the infinitive construct of the third hey root, asa. Third hey's end in oath. From doing. He will not fail from doing peri. Peri means fruit. All right. Note that do usually has the implication of make or produce. And he will not fail from producing fruit. All right, there's your translation. Now, a couple of comments. One, the parallel to Psalm 1 is not accidental. It's interesting that commentaries will debate, of course, chicken and egg here. Traditionally, Psalm 1 has been dated in higher critical theories very, very late and, in a sense, dependent on passages like this. There are more and more scholars, even higher critical ones, who are suggesting that Psalm 1 may, in fact, be early and, therefore, is the source of Jeremiah 17. Now, again, that's kind of a chicken and egg argument. It would seem to me that assuming Psalm 1 was at least in place or well-known or had themes that were well-known, what does Jeremiah, I mean, here's my sort of homily, this is your children's sermon, I guess. What does Jeremiah do when he's down in the dumps spiritually? He goes to the book of Psalms and starts remembering stuff. Okay? Now, there's a point in all of that. This is why you memorize Bible verses. This is why you live in the hymnal, that this stuff becomes part of you. So when they turn off the lights or pull the plug or we have nuclear war, you've got something to fall back on, okay? And then secondly, what's overall the point of all of this passage? Well, obviously, the theme is trusting in Yahweh, even against all earthly appearances, and the metaphor to a tree. Well, okay, any questions on this? Then we'll do a little Greek.